Session number 11944.
Judge Jaland, Reel 9. You were saying that when the German tank crew came running along the front line, your own men jumped up out of their slit trenches.
Yes, and ran away towards my left, hotly pursued by the German tank crew. Some people further away, some of our own troops, seeing the Germans running away, immediately jumped out of their trenches and ran after the Germans. As a result, sitting where I was at the back of the field, I got a sort of curbstone cop picture of the people running all over the place, all in single file. Happily, the whole thing ended satisfactorily in that the Germans were captured, and that was that. I was very pleased we'd managed to knock out this tank. It was a Tiger. Highly commended, congratulated all round. And the commanding officer thought that it would be a good idea if, in order to stop the Germans coming along and recovering the tank, that the pioneer officer should destroy it. Lieutenant Pugh, I remember. So he came along and duly set the tank on fire, which caused a tremendous column of smoke and obviously gave the impression to the Germans that we were about to attack. And they therefore subjected us to an enormous barrage, which went on for ages and was very uncomfortable. And I know Lieutenant Pugh was not the most popular man with my platoon at the end of the evening. That was one sort of annoyance. Another feature which annoyed us at the time was the psychological warfare. Bright people with loudspeakers and microphones used to come into our area, set up their equipment, and then bawl at the Germans over the loudspeakers, telling them that the war was over as far as they were concerned, and the sooner they surrendered, the better. We didn't like it, because as soon as they started, the Germans shelled and mortared the position very thoroughly, and it was very unpleasant indeed, because of the... we didn't like it, we didn't approve of it anyway. One of the features that I do remember there, which was very good, was the artificial moonlight, which is the first time I'd come across that, where they shone searchlights from behind our position onto the clouds over the Germans' position, which illuminated the area immediately to our front perfectly, so we could see more or less any movement, whereas the Germans were effectively blinded, as I understood, and couldn't see what we were doing, rather like footlights on a theatre stage. But that was one of the features I remember at the Bocage. I was also terribly impressed by the 74 field at that stage, because it was then that they were giving us tremendous artillery support. On a number of occasions they came up with assistance, because we had a series of targets which were marked on the map. I think they were called Victor target, V targets. And if we were worried about something happening, crossroads or something like that in front of us, we'd only got to send a signal back saying Victor target number so-and-so, and the 74th field could be relied upon to absolutely shell the place very considerably, very effectively. And we'd been very fond of the 74th field for years. Another sort of Victor target we had at that time, which again came into its own very well in the close country, were the heavy machine guns. We had the Cheshires with us, or some of the Cheshires, and they had the heavy water-cooled Vickers machine gun. They had Victor targets as well, and we could call them up if necessary, and they would set their machine guns going, and they would fire away for a long time, 10, 15 minutes non-stop on the target area, which again was very reassuring from our point of view. It was also in the Bocage that we came across the 2nd Tactical Air Force to great effect. And these were typhoons, which were used to ride in a sort of taxi rank, fly in a taxi rank, over our heads, going round and round. And when they spotted a target, or when they were given a target and we had an air link to them, or the battalion did, they would peel off and attack whatever the target was with rockets. That was most effective, and they were very good, and they were quite capable of picking out one individual tank in a secluded position and destroying it for us. In order to assist this, of course, we were always wearing fluorescent panels inside our battle dress. And if by any chance the fighters started to attack us, then all we had to do was to whip these fluorescent panels out, hold them out in front of us with a hand at each corner, and that was sufficient to cause the fighters to stop. And, of course, at the same time, we had our typhoons and hurricanes doing the usual strafing work on our front. So really it was very active, very interesting, a lot of patrolling going on at that stage. I went out many times. I forget the names of the places around there now, but there was Cemento, Chateau de Cornillon, Hotto, Parc de la Mer, Cemento. I went many times to get into Hotto. I never got into Hotto. I did get as far as the outskirts one day and trod on the strip wire, which fortunately only fired a flare, and there were no ill consequences from my patrol's point of view from that, although it was worrying at the time. We did get down to the Chateau de Cordillon and actually got inside the grounds through a hole in the wall one night. And found out there were quite a lot of tanks in there being repaired by the mechanics and people operating inside. So altogether, it was in fact a very close field of combat. We were there for some weeks, I think.
Did the Germans do a lot of patrolling as well?
No, I remember one patrol came up to the hedge on the other side of my bank, and it was so near a patrol that in the moonlight that I could really have stretched out and touched him. That was that. He went and drifted past, and I didn't do anything about it at that time. The Germans, of course, at that stage, the German officers seemed to use eau de cologne a lot. And I agree with those people who say that in the dark it was possible to smell Germans. They smelt entirely different from ourselves, and certainly the officers with their eau de cologne. It was quite remarkable. But whether it was the German food, whatever they were eating, they certainly had a body smell which...
was not British.
Yes. And so we knew that they were there, which is useful.
Did they do much sniping in your area?
Who, the Germans?
The Germans.
The Germans did, but so did our snipers. It was ideal country for them. They had a field day, really. They were going out and shooting. I remember they came back one day, came back through my position, and they'd apparently just shot somebody on the lavatory, which had given them a certain amount of amusement. But they'd also caught a German, not the same day, they'd also caught some Germans queuing up for their food. And they'd managed to kill one or two of them as they were actually queuing up to collect the rations.
At the company kitchens?
Yes, that sort of thing. And, it wasn't pleasant then. Parc de la Mer and that area, La Taille, very close. And again, it was, but on the other hand, it was frustrating. We couldn't move as we wanted.
You were saying about the 74th Field hitting the victor targets. Roughly how long would it be between the signal and the shells arriving on the target?
Minutes. Very quickly. Oh, sorry. Same with the Vickers. They were onto it very, very quickly. And certainly if you had obviously you were expecting troop movements and so on. and that was why you wanted them to move quickly and catch convoys and so on, whatever it was.
What was your link with the artillery? Did you have a direct telephone
line? No, we went through a battalion.
But did you have a telephone line then back? Because you mentioned telephones and radios.
Yes.
They didn't work terribly well.
Well, the radios were always going wrong somehow. We had telephones, usually, with a field line. And we could get them pretty quickly. And, of course, we weren't all that far apart, really. I mean, if the worst came to the worst, you could send somebody literally to run with a message if you couldn't get through. But it worked pretty well.
Were you so close because it was such close country and you had to have a high density of troops to hold the ground?
Oh, no. No, it was a case that we just happened to be not very far apart, really. I suppose the battalion headquarters would be in a suitable building that they'd found somewhere and centrally somewhere, and that was the way it happened. It wasn't a case of all being packed tight because of the enemy coming or anything like that, no. I think probably, as far as defending it was concerned, you'd need fewer men than you would with ordinary open country, as the Germans were proving to us, showing us.
Did they make a lot of use of mines in their defence in the Bocage?
Yes, S mines again. And also packets of gun cotton. Sorry. Yes, packets of gun cotton with a charge detonator and a piece of wire or string across. They were using that, which had a blast effect. It was very nasty. But it was purely to catch somebody on a footpath or passageway.
What about wire? Did they have a plentiful amount of that?
Do you know, I can't remember any wire. Don't remember any wire at all. There's certainly no barbed wire fences or dannet wire or none of that, as I remember. And I would have done with all that patrolling.
What about our own positions? Were they wired in?
No. I don't know why. I don't think so. No.
And how were they actually laid out and constructed, our front line?
Well, there was a series of slit trenches.
Were they the familiar two-man slit trenches?
Or? No, because these were the ones that were chiefly, they were dug into the bank. So the chaps seemed to, we let them have a free hand to some extent. And as long as they got a good field of fire, they could have one to sit in or cut into the bank so they'd sit in it and be protected, as well as the ordinary slit trench on the ground. But, and also, of course, with the slit trench in the bank, they usually drilled a hole right through so they could fire through the bank as well as over the top.
Well, they made a loophole then.
Yeah, which was very effective, very good. The Germans, of course, did the same. They taught us how to do it. And they had most complicated arrangements. But one of the things which I do remember very well was to realise that the Germans so thorough on this occasion that they always had a ground sheet behind their slit trench cut into the bank so that there would be no daylight showing through the hole in the bank. It was a small thing, but it was... Oh! It's the same one telephone. Sorry about that.
You're saying the Germans always put a sheet over the
back,
hole, the loophole, so that they could...
Well, behind them.
Behind them, so they would be... They'd have the ground sheet behind them and they would be looking through the loophole.
Yes, and so they were dark, you couldn't see through it. You couldn't see the outline, you couldn't see where they were firing from. There was... people had all sorts of ways of dealing with this, I remember. The Captain Meyer, we had a company commander... he decided that he was a man from a battle school, I remember, and he decided that the best way to deal with German machine guns was 8 determined men with fixed bayonets. So we organised this for him to lead, and we provided all our machine brain guns, and we provided all our smoke, we got it all ready, and when the time came, we laid down the smoke, and we started firing rapid with the guns, machine guns, Bren guns, and he started off, and he was very badly wounded himself, and a number of his men were hurt, because it was such a ridiculous idea and theoretical. It just wouldn't work, and no, we knew it wouldn't, with crossfire across a small field, and with spandos in it. So that was difficult. We used to keep them occupied with mortars, our own little mortars. We used to amuse ourselves by trying to get them on the top of their positions, and we did everything. Sometimes we got the anti-tank guns up. If we thought there was a hole in the bank, we'd get a 6-pounder anti-tank gun up and put an anti-tank gun to it. We also used the, of course, on those occasions, the Panzer Fists, I forget the correct name. Yes, we got some of those, and we were using them against them, and they were very useful. They were the rocket things.
Well, these were captured from the enemy.
Yes. But those were very useful. But it was an interesting period.
How far away were the Germans most of the time? Were they only a field away?
Only a field away. And, of course, you could hear them further over, more than a field away, but most of them were 50, 100 yards, probably. I mean, you could shout to each other. And people did.
What sort of things did they shout to each other?
You Schweinhund and that sort of thing. And so on. But it was, I think, ribald observations. I remember that was, at one period, they were mortaring us very hard. And we had a corporal who, not without his sense of fun, and the platoon next to mine was very heavily shelled or bombed, mortar bombed, and it really went on for a terrible long time, and we were glad it wasn't on us. And then they stopped, and we had visions of the Germans moving their mortars along to deal with us, and the little corporal jumped up, broad Geordie, roared out the order, same range, same target, carry on. And that was the sort of atmosphere there was about at the time. And I don't know really what else you want to know about that part of it.
You mentioned Hotto. Did you take part in any of the attacks on Hotto?
No.
Because there were about three or four attempts.
They were done by the Hampshires or somebody. There was an incident there where we were warned that we were going to get the biggest artillery barrage since Alamein, with the Corps artillery coming in, and it was to take 2-3-1 brigade through, and they were going to leapfrog through us. In due course they started, and something had gone wrong, and the shells were on our rear companies, and they shelled us all the way up, and the final 5 minutes stonk was more or less on my position, just a little bit in front of it, and that was followed up by wild Devons, Hampshires and Dorsets, whoever they were, coming through, and they'd no idea we were there, and they finished in our lines. They never got any further on that particular attack. They moved forward later, but
clearly a case of map reading error then.
Something went wrong. Not only by not only the guns, but with the infantry too. It wasn't just one man who made a mistake there. Can't have been. Obviously, if the 231 brigade had done a reconnaissance, if they'd had a look at the ground, if they'd come forward to the forward position, could never have happened. But they were a bit inclined to be impetuous, I think. I remember that the day after this had happened, the two commanding officers met in my area, and I was introduced to the Hampshire's commanding officer, and my commanding officer said that I was a rather good patrolling chap. And the Hampshire officer said, well, perhaps you'd like to do something for me. And as I was doing more than my share for the Durhams, I wasn't prepared to go and mess about for the Hampshires as well. But anyway, it was, I don't think he really meant it. But we got on very well with them, but except for the complete cock-up.
How long were you actually in the Bocage without relief?
Don't know. Can't remember. I thought about it. It seems to have been quite a long time, and yet it can't have been as long as all that. But it was, in fact, I think weeks. And we were there with nobody coming up until the Hampshires came.
Were you at all aware of what was going on within the division and
no.
the war and the army?
No, this was it. This is, what I said, there was a complete lack of communication. Just as we'd been told that it was little men, Boy Scouts with pistols, and that sort of information. We had to rely for our information, not from our company commanders, but people like the mortar officer, Captain O'Connor, or Cyril Catford, who was the anti-tank officer, the officers wandering round, seeing to their own chaps, and, of course, Archie Bock, intelligence man, who was magnificent. He really was first class, and he later got an immediate commission in the field, Archie. But he would tell us what was going on, and he also produced the sort of big picture to know that Patton was going round here and Khan had been taken or whatever it happened to be. But by and large, we were just aimed at Villers-Bocage, that's all we knew. And it was very difficult to get information. And the answer was always, when you inquired, the answer was always, you'll be told if you need to know. And so from the platoon commander's point of view, it was lack of information. I think a lot of good would have been done. So perhaps I'm wanting too much from the D-Day, the overlord information. Perhaps I was greedy for information there, but I certainly think further on we should have had more, much more than we did, to pass on to the men.
How did the position of the Bocage eventually resolve itself?
I don't know. I think the people out there, I know the 6th DLI went through us at one stage and they moved forward quite a long way. And then there'd been all this terrific bombing of Villers-Bocage itself and Ornay, where they'd been wiped out by the Lancasters. And that was nasty. But I think in due course, I can't remember now whether we pulled out or whether we moved forward or whether somebody went through us or not. I don't know. I know the 6th had a big attack there, somewhere around that area, towards the end of it. And then, of course, the next thing we were off to Mount Pinson and that area. But how on what happened at the end? Again, I've been thinking, knowing you were coming, I've been trying to think what happened at the end of it, and I just can't.
Did you actually go through Villers-Bocage?
Later we went through Villers-Bocage. We did go through. We went through Villers-Bocage in lorries. I think, in fact, we may have started becoming motorised. Because I know that to get through they'd put bulldozers on. And Villers-Bocage was so flat there was no wall over about 6 feet tall. And they just put bulldozers through so we could drive through the rubble. Straight through.
So after you're saying the 6th went through and went ahead of you quite a long way.
No, I think they were further over. I don't think they went through us. I think it was the Hampshires who went through us.
Were they actually opposed, or were they following up as the enemy were retiring?
I think the Hampshires caught a packet, and I think the 6th caught a packet. I'm not sure if I remember this from then, or from the result of my recent battlefield tour that I've appreciated, that I saw a big memorial to the... I think that was in Hotto, to the Devons and Dorsets and Hampshires, I think so, a big one, big memorial. But I don't remember that at the time.
So, did you take part in any formal set-piece attacks in the Bocage yourself?
No.
Thrown into
no. The only set-piece attack we had was, I remember, was Mount Pinson. And, yes, that was the only one, I think, that happened.
What happened there?
Well, a tack went in and we had tanks with us. Everybody went to the top. And, again, a certain amount of confusion coming and going. I think people had some casualties, certainly. I think Colonel Lidwell was hurt there. And then we moved over to the other side of the hill and dug in a position there. And it was from there that we became really motorised and ready to deal with the Falaise Gap and started moving. I think that was the end of the actual Normandy campaign, as far as we were concerned, then Mount Pansel. I know it was a set-piece battle. I know that it was regarded as being highly successful and brilliantly performed and executed. Again, having been back in the last 4 years, had to look around. I've not the least idea where I was or where anybody else was. It's all fog of war, the whole thing.
Do you remember if there was very strong opposition on the...
Oh, yes. There was a lot there, and the Germans there were using a naval gun, which they were firing from somewhere way inland somewhere, and that was firing huge shells which were making tremendous craters, dropping into our positions.
This was presumably on a railway mounting of some sort, wasn't
it? I don't know. I know it was a big naval gun, 16-inch or something. So we were told it was a big one, but it was very effective. But you could hear it coming. Great advantage was it sounded like a kit bag turning over and over and over very slowly, and it gave you plenty of time to get into a slit trench or somewhere before it landed. Not like the 88s.
So having gone through the rather confused battle at Mont Pansel, where I think it was the 13th, 18th who were...
The armour.
The armour and support.
Yeah.
You were then... You say you were motorised from that time on, and this was the beginning of the Falaise Gap operation. What did you do in that operation?
Well, as far as that was concerned, I think the rot had started, and we were chased over towards the northern side of the bag, where the Germans were trying to get out. Well, yes, again, we're moving so quickly then, we didn't know what was happening. And I remember seeing the Falaise Gap, and I remember being absolutely appalled by the way in which the German columns had been destroyed. It was quite awe-inspiring. A lot of dead horses, I always remember that, as well as dead men. Apparently they were still using safe petrol, they were still using horse-drawn transport for the guns and for the carts. Lot of dead people about, very nasty, very effective, of course, from the Typhoon's point of view, the Air Force point of view. And also, that's the first place I came across where, and the first time I was aware of the fact, that the Germans were hanging their own deserters. And we came across an orchard there with half a dozen Germans who had been hanged for running away. And apparently the SS or somebody was dealing with the caught them as deserters. They immediately took them out and hanged them. And we came across them with their feet just a few inches off the ground, swaying gently in the wind.
Many more. I can't remember where that was.
No, somewhere around the Falaise Gap area. Obviously, they've been doing their best. No, I don't remember, no. And I know we didn't stop. It wasn't a case of stopping, cutting them down or anything. We just pushed on. It was just one of those things. And we hadn't realised, of course, that there were anti-desertion tactics being used. We'd never come across that sort of thing before or since. I never saw it again. And then from there, we started moving. And on this sort of column until eventually we got to Vernon on the Seine. Very little I can remember about those journeys. I know I went across there at high speed. We stopped the night at Vernon on the bridge there. We got there before they blew it. And on that night, when we reached the Seine, I went off in a jeep, and I think it may have been with Archie Bark, but I'm not sure, the intelligence chap who had a jeep. I had no jeep, of course. But we went off towards Paris, which was only just down the road. And we got to the stage where, in the evening, we could see the Eiffel Tower. We're as near to Paris as that. And we stopped and decided to go back. We hadn't met any Germans at all the whole way. And we understood that we were going to capture Paris, going to be given Paris. And, of course, we could have taken it the next day. But we were, for political reasons, we were told that Paris must be liberated by General de Gaulle and the Free French, who at that stage had not even landed. They weren't even in France. They were still back in the UK. So we were held back from going in. Whether or not it was because the Parisians had appreciated that the English were somewhere near, that they rose and were treated so harshly by the Germans, who killed all the gendarmes and everybody else, and battle around the gendarmerie and Notre Dame and so on, where they rose prematurely. If they waited just a little bit, the Free French would have come and taken it. But perhaps I caused the Archie and I started the excitement, I don't know. And then we went across from there to due course to Amiens, Arras and those places, and the message then was, because of the devastation being caused by the V1s and V2s, we had to clear them and we had to get round there and get them stopped, because they were creating tremendous havoc in the southeast. Also, it had been decreed that to some extent we should be allowed to go back along the Dunkirk route, and as far as possible. And the battalion went back that way, and they were so good with it, the people organised it.